This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Welcome to Libri. Thank you for coming. It's great to see so many faces here tonight. There's many other things one could do on a Friday night, so we appreciate people coming out. We didn't even promise happiness, and yet people can't. Yeah, sorry. People leave right now. I'll understand. So this is the first lecture in our weekend seminar, which is this evening and tomorrow. There'll be two lectures tomorrow, so it's a three-part series. And our title for the entire event is A Flash of Eternity: Happiness, Joy, and the Good Life. We were trying to think of a title that would sort of capture something of the breadth of what we're trying to talk about. And it was a lot of discussion and a lot of reflection on how to come up with a good representative title. A Flash of Eternity, meaning these moments in which we experience joy are an indication of who we are and who made us and what our ultimate destiny is. But trying to engage in the broader conversation of what happiness is today, which is a very, very active and confusing conversation that's going on in our culture. What we'll do both tonight and tomorrow is we're incorporating Sarah Chestnut, who is one of our workers here and is a poet and a great appreciator of poetry. We'll be reading a poem at the end of each lecture, which will help us, I think, to sort of kick off the discussion time after the lecture, but also gives us another way in to understanding happiness and joy, another voice that can help us engage with something that's not always easy to engage with. It's not always easy to just in lecture form explain what something is, but we'll engage with it on a different level through the poetry. And then Sarah, because she understands poetry more than most of us, will help us into the poems just a little bit. So tonight, that's the title of the whole thing. And then tonight is my lecture, which is the introductory one, Life's Elusive Goal: Reflections on Contemporary Views of Happiness. And one of the things that, as I have been reading about this, excuse me while I adjust this a little bit, I had a metaphor that came to my mind, which was kind of confirmed the longer I reflected on it and the more things I read. And that's of a boat on the ocean. I looked for some snappy photographs. I couldn't find very good ones, but this is a nice underwater shot. The ocean is a very unstable place. Imagine a harbor, basically. You know, even within a harbor, there's waves, there's wind, there may be currents, all of which have the power to push the boat in different directions. And so there's a lot of potential for chaos when you're a boat floating on water. If the boat is at anchor, like this boat is, it'll be pushed around by all these forces, but its location is not entirely open-ended, right? The anchor is a heavy weight, basically, resting on the bottom of the ocean, and the ship only moves as far as the anchor chain allows it to move, however long the anchor chain is. So this prevents it from drifting off into the open ocean. It also prevents it from being wrecked on the rocks or smashing into other boats or all the things that we don't want if we own a boat. If the ship has not dropped anchor and no one is actually at the helm sailing it, it will spin and drift wherever the wind, the waves, the current take it. which could be anywhere, out to sea or on the rocks, or if that's just a nice picture of a empty boat floating away. So this is a picture of a lack of control and a potential disaster. And then there's this third option, which is me, it's a bit of a stretch. I don't think this is a real thing, but I just, for the sake of the metaphor, I decided to go with this. You could drop the anchor chain with no anchor on the end. So there's no anchor, there's no actual weight attached to it. There's no way of actually gripping the bottom of the ocean. You just drop the chain, and the chain is dragging along bottom. And it may slow the ship down a little bit as it drifts, but it will not actually hold the ship in place. The chain is nowhere near heavy enough. It has no way to actually hold the bottom. So the ship is still adrift, whether you realize it or not. It's just drifting maybe slightly slower. So this is my working analogy that will hopefully become clear as the lecture goes on. It's a way that has helped me to think of some of these contemporary notions of what happiness is. So the boat at anchor, the boat adrift, and then the boat that thinks it's at anchor. So my first goal tonight is to confuse you with the confusing seascape that is the contemporary conversation about happiness. It is a bit like looking at the ocean and everything is moving. Thoughts and opinions about happiness are diverse and they're constantly changing. So if you did a poll of people's opinions about happiness, it would not necessarily bring you much clarity as to what happiness actually is. If you spent a day on the street asking people, what is happiness to you? There's no guarantee you would come back with any clearer sense of what it was at the end of the day. The dictionary definition is bland and not very illuminating, I found. It's the state of feeling or showing pleasure or contentment. Okay? There are many, many contradictory views of happiness in the world today, and I'm just kind of almost off the cuff, listing some views of happiness with their equal opposite version of happiness immediately following. So life is a journey to find happiness. Happiness is the goal or purpose of life. That's a very, very common belief. Or a lot of people say, no, happiness isn't about a destination, as if something you need to accomplish and then you'll be happy. No, it's about the journey. It's about a way of being as you move along in life, as you try to achieve goals. It's not about the goal; it's about how you, but your attitude towards life as you journey. Some people would say that happiness is something that everyone deserves. It's a right; everybody has a right to be happy. Lots of other people say no; it's something you really have to work on to achieve. Happiness is work, and to actually arrive at happiness takes a lot of effort, and it takes a lot of effort to maintain happiness. So it's a project in your life, something that you want to work on. Does our country guarantee our right to pursue happiness or our right to happiness? the question. I think different people have different attitudes towards this. Many people live implicitly as if the latter were true. I'm somehow guaranteed happiness. If I don't feel happy, then there's some sense in which my rights have been violated here. A lot of people would say that happiness is circumstantial. In other words, it's dependent on getting what we want, dependent on life circumstances. Comfort, maybe financial security, the right job, good relationships. If only I could get blank, then I would be happy. Or if only my life shaped up, or if only this difficult thing went away, then I would be happy. So this assumption that somehow life circumstances are the ingredients to happiness. Some people really do still believe that if I just make enough money, then I'll be happy, right? You know, a lot of people, actually. Others say, no, money can never buy happiness. Happiness is about your mindset towards life, regardless of your circumstances. We watched on Wednesday night, which is kind of the informal start of this event. Dave showed the documentary Happy, and there was an interesting, I believe, a psychologist, or I don't remember what his name was, but he made this. He said something really interesting. He said the expression "money can never buy money can't buy you happiness," and the expression "money can buy you happiness." Neither of those is true all the time for everyone, right? And I think, and this person was making the point that if a person is truly destitute and really suffering from the effects of poverty, whether they're homeless, they may be malnourished, a bit of money can actually go a long way in increasing their happiness. So it's not as if money has nothing to do with happiness. However, if you already have your basic needs met and you're fairly comfortable, studies suggest that making more money will not lead to greater happiness. So there's a distinction there, which I found really interesting. Okay, I'm continuing my effort to confuse you. A lot of people would say happiness is something you can achieve only by being true to yourself, by following your heart, by not letting other people restrict you in any way. Or many people would say happiness is something you only achieve by putting the needs of others before your own, through service, through love, through sacrifice. There's somehow greater rewards in giving than in receiving. And a lot of people would say that. A lot of people would say happiness is something that we should expect to experience in life. Some people would say it's only the lucky few that actually are happy. Many people pursue happiness by seeking pleasurable experience after pleasurable experience, trying to string together experiences of enjoyment to maintain a particular emotional high. That's the way a lot of people view happiness. Whether they articulate that or not, that's the way in which they seek after happiness, right? To try to keep a stream of enjoyable circumstances going. To other people, this just sounds exhausting, and we dismiss it as not a good way to live. Some people say happiness is found in finding the time to do what you love, whatever those things are, whether it's art, exercise, reading, friendships, family, being outside in creation, whatever it happens to be life-giving to you. These things give our lives meaning, which leads to happiness. Sounds very nice. Others say that's great if your life allows time for your hobbies and all these other things. Is there any such thing as happiness for people who don't have a particular passion or who never have the margin enough to engage in recreation? And then there's a lot of people are very cynical towards happiness. So this is yet another take on happiness. Many people feel that life has not delivered on expectations, and it is best to just lower your expectations in order to protect yourself and get by. They've become resigned to the disappointment and boredom of life. So life is just blah. And for many of these people, happiness is not a positive state to strive towards. It's just about avoiding pain in a world without meaning. And that's the highest goal that anybody really is going for, just to avoid pain in a world that's basically meaningless. And so entertainment functions as a great distraction. We think entertainment makes us happy because it just helps us to avoid pain momentarily. Sexual pleasure can function as a distraction in this way. A whole array of substances can function as a distraction in this way. But the whole endeavor is essentially a negative one. We're not seeking a positive thing. We're just trying to avoid pain. And that's what happiness has been reduced to. Whether this is how someone describes it or not, I think this is how a lot of people live. This is sort of the working definition of happiness for many people. What are the ways in which I can just avoid pain? What are the ways in which I can avoid thinking about my past, the things that have been done to me, the things that I really at all costs want to forget and not think about? So This is a very, very, very sad picture of happiness. It's not actually happiness. So, if you're confused by all the street level opinions, these are the kinds of things you might, conversations you might get into on the street with anybody, then you can go to the bookstore and ask someone to direct you to the self-help section of the bookstore. And before we do that, actually, I'm just going to show a couple things. I meant to show this earlier. My colleague Anna has sent me a bunch of photographs she took with her phone. Examples of how happiness is portrayed as just the obvious point of life. and something that is achievable through making the right purchases. Right? So happiness is not just this worthy, desirable goal in life. It's something that is at your fingertips, you know, and is used in the world of advertising to sell things to us. This is what will get you happiness. So, let's see if I can read these all. It's all about happiness. I'm not sure what this is. Happiness with an E. How I Live Happy. Hot on the Happiness Front. These are new books about happiness. Tune into your happy place. This is a live happier, better, longer. Be happy and live longer. So happiness is tied to longevity. It's one of the things that the documentary you watched on Wednesday night talked about. People who are happier live longer. This is why, evidently, people in Okinawa, who have very tight communities, there's a very high level of happiness in this culture, and it's the highest concentration of people over 100 anywhere in the world. And then this is happiness having to do with coffee. Both of these, I think.
No, that one's like an odor. It's like an odor gel, but it says.
Oh, it's a gel.
Happiness is just seconds away.
Happiness is just seconds away. Yeah. Life doesn't have to stink. Happiness is just seconds away. Oh yes. Yeah, happiness is a cup of coffee and a really good book. Yeah. A lot of these little sayings and things that you find are examples of something that might add to someone's happiness, but whether that's the actual definition of happiness is another issue. But yeah, anyway, just a couple of examples. Thank you, Anna, for those. So this is just one example of a self-help. This is a small self-help section, actually. I think it's only a portion of a self-help section. But if you go looking for clarity about happiness by looking at the self-help section of your local bookstore, if you have one. There's a deluge of books, and almost no matter what the topic and the title, they're all dealing with happiness in some way. Right? Happiness is sort of the undercurrent. How do you get it? How do you increase it? What must I do to become more happy in a few manageable steps? This is something that Jonathan Haidt calls too much wisdom. And in this, I ordered this from Amazon just a few days ago, and it arrived yesterday afternoon, so I haven't given this a solid read yet. But it's his book, The Happiness Hypothesis. It looks really interesting. Anyway, I'll read you a quote from the second page of the book, which I found immediately compelling. Like, wow, this is great. Now I might read the whole thing. So he's talking about too much wisdom. Today. Wisdom is now so cheap and abundant that it floods over us from calendar pages, tea bags, bottle caps, and mass email messages forwarded by well-meaning friends. Yet, because our library is effectively infinite, no one person can ever read more than a tiny fraction. We face a paradox of abundance. Quantity undermines the quality of our engagement. With such a vast and wonderful library spread out before us, we often skim books and read just reviews. We might already have encountered the greatest idea, the insight that would have transformed us had we savored it, taken it to heart, and worked it into our lives. But there's just such a vast quantity of advice about happiness, we feel like we better keep looking, and really we don't take anything on board at all. It's just such a... We just let it wash over us. So happiness is obviously really, really, really important to people today, and probably to most of us too. It's important in our culture. Its importance goes without saying. You wouldn't have to convince somebody that happiness was important, usually. There's a commonly held assumption that no one really has to articulate today that happiness is the point of life. To find it is the central purpose for every person. The question of whether something will make you happy or not is basically the central factor in how we live our lives and make decisions. So basically, is this going to make me happy or not? This will be the deciding factor in our decision making. And so a lot of what I've just said is agreed on, and yet we're still looking at a seascape. It's still very confusing, multiple conflicting opinions. So how do we enter in here? I thought just a word about the flow of these lectures that we're going to be doing. My lecture is really trying to help us think a little bit about sort of contemporary ideas of happiness, many of which I find lacking. The emphasis of my lecture is not going to be, okay, so here's a really good, well-developed biblical alternative. I will say some things at the end, but a lot of that will be developed further by Joshua and Dave tomorrow, really digging into biblical texts more and getting at what the Bible actually is communicating about happiness. So that my lecture is in comparison kind of a downer. But one of the things I want to talk about is unhappiness, which is an important thing to think about. This is another bewildering thing about this seascape we're looking out at. There's never been more advice about how to be happy, and there's probably never been so many unhappy people. I can't back that up with any statistic, but there are a lot of statistics that suggest that. Never before have we been so well equipped to become happy and have been yet so unhappy. Something's not working. So the world is a profoundly complex and at times tragic place, and those of us who live in it are dealing with unhappiness all the time. And of course there are many, many external causes for human misery. We're not just talking about our internal psychological state. There's poverty, there's sickness, there is loneliness and disconnection from other people. There's political injustice all over the world. There's physical and sexual abuse. There's disconnection from places. We feel rootless, like we don't belong anywhere. There's a history of broken relationships. There's vocational disappointments where our jobs and our vocational life just didn't end up where we wanted it to. There's physical disability. There's war. There's death all around us. And these things have always been a part of living in a world that's broken. This is not new. Nothing about this is new. And yet there is evidence to suggest that people are becoming less and less able to cope with the reality of evil and suffering in the world, cope emotionally to these realities. Rates of anxiety and depression in America are steadily on the rise. One in every five college students in America suffers from anxiety or depression on some level, sometimes quite debilitating. One positive psychologist that I'll be quoting a lot later, Tal Ben-Shahar, He claims that Western culture is approaching emotional bankruptcy. And by that he means a widespread inability to find happiness at all. It's a very general statement, obviously, but... and all this is the case in a context in which we know more than any other generation about how to maximize our happiness. We should be experts at managing our emotional lives. You know, if the self-help shelves are any indication... recent statistics show that between 1999 and 2016, suicide rates have increased in every state except Nevada, interestingly, which amounts to a 25% increase nationally between 1999 and 2016, a 25% increase in suicide rates. In 2016, there was more than twice as many suicides as homicides. The Center for Disease Control has a lot to say about this. This is a quote. CDC officials, however, said that the national increase in suicide rates cannot be linked to a particular mental health diagnosis. Some people disagree with that. Some people say it's just that lots of people are never diagnosed and they actually do have mental health issues who commit suicide. But the whole question, people are desperate to find a mental illness behind suicide rather than a total depression coming from the lack of meaning in the world and a lack of any viable answers to this. Another quote from this article. The new analysis found that nearly 45,000 Americans aged 10 or older died by their own hand in 2016. It varied widely from state to state. But social isolation, lack of mental health treatment, drug and alcohol abuse, and gun ownership are among the factors that contribute to suicide. But what are the answers? What do people have to say about this? Well, we just need to somehow diagnose people with mental health problems earlier, somehow have to do something about gun ownership, something about drug and alcohol abuse, but never getting at the question of lack of meaning, right? So, another tidbit. In January of this year, 2018, the Prime Minister of England, Theresa May, appointed a Minister of Loneliness. This has been getting a lot of press lately. Whose job it is to combat what has been called an epidemic of loneliness in the UK. So loneliness has been shown to contribute to many physiological and psychological problems, so much so that the appointment by Theresa May is really a response to a public health crisis. This is how it's being viewed. Loneliness epidemic is a public health crisis. People are rootless. They're not finding meaningful connection with other people. They feel chronically isolated, and most of the smaller institutions that provided a social context for people have been undermined or wiped out by various movements in modernity, in the mobility of people where jobs take us in a million different directions. So much so that loneliness is considered in the UK a viable threat to society. And this is, of course, very sobering, and I don't think it should be surprising to us. But again, how do we enter into this? How do we start? And I want to talk a little bit about the longing for happiness. The longing for happiness, we see it everywhere. In a sense, everything that we've been talking about so far is an indication that people are longing for happiness, longing for something other than what they see and experience. And I want to say that it's a legitimate longing. I would go so far as to say that human beings were made, among other things, to be happy. So, if this is the case, it should not surprise us that if this is what we were made, one of the reasons we were made, one of the things we were made to be, it should not surprise us that people are desperate to find it. People long for contentment because they are restless and dissatisfied. People long for intimate relationships because they are isolated and lonely. People long for security because they feel afraid and anxious. People long for fulfillment because they feel a lack of meaning, like their efforts are pointless in life. People long for satisfaction, maybe connected to work, for the satisfaction of working and seeing your work amount to something, because so much work feels futile. People long for positive emotions because their lives are full of painful experiences and disappointments. And so there's every reason to expect that if human beings are what we think they are, as Christians, that we should long for happiness. I think the longing for happiness is one example of human beings being human in a fallen world. I think there is a dormant awareness of the goodness that we've fallen from, which makes the bent world a painful place to be in. An awareness of something good that we've fallen from that makes the brokenness of the world painful to us. And this is not this is not a necessarily a conscious awareness or something that people articulate, but I think many people who aren't Christians at all and have no worldview to support this, still, because they're made in the image of God, experience this sense that this is not how things should have been, right? Which is this kind of dormant or latent awareness that things should have been different. There's a sense that something must have gone horribly wrong to explain what we see around us and to explain our own gut-level response to it. So we experience this ache of estrangement from God. Many of us are unaware of what it is, but it's an ache of the old estrangement from God. In an essay by Jeremy Begbie, he quotes George Steiner. I haven't read this book that this is quoted from, but it's from a book called Errata, An Examined Life, and it's a really powerful, disturbing quote in which George Steiner is essentially explaining his experience on reflecting on evil and how, on a existential level, he's convinced of the fall, somehow. And this is George Steiner writing, "At the maddening center of despair is the insistent instinct, again, I can put it no other way, of a broken contract, of an appalling and specific cataclysm. In the futile scream of a child, in the mute agony of an animal, sounds the background noise of a horror after creation. Something, how helpless language can be, has gone hideously wrong. I am possessed, as by a midnight clarity, by the intuition of the fall. Only some such happening, irretrievable to reason, can make intelligible, though always near to unbearable, the actualities of our history on this wasted earth." So he has this sense that something has gone terribly wrong. This is not normal in the sense that it was as the world was intended somehow. And I would add that this intuitive sense of wrongness implies that there was and is a rightness, something real and glorious that is negated by evil and human sin and suffering. And so it's a longing for this rightness, whatever it is, I think, that drives all of our wandering searches for happiness. Even the most self-centered, narcissistic longing for happiness, there's something at the core of it that is an awareness that things are not as they should have been. So, for these reasons, Christians of all people should not scoff at the widespread search for happiness. I think we may need to define happiness in a very different way, and there's lots of things we can say that we might be critical of how the world views happiness, but we shouldn't scoff at it or scorn it as being trivial or superficial or something like that. Because the fact is, we were, like I said, made for, among other things, happiness. It's very often the case in Christian circles that there's an exaggerated dichotomy between joy and happiness. I don't know if that, has that been people's experience, where people talk about joy over here and then happiness over here. Within this mindset, joy is an experience of the eternal. It's an experience of spiritual realities. It's what Christians experience when they focus their minds and hearts on heavenly things. And in contrast, happiness is trivialized as a superficial emotion that's dependent on circumstances. So it's something that Christians should not be concerned with. We should be transcending it because we're fed by much more deep and eternal realities. Let the world worry about positive emotions. We have joy. So this manifests itself in different ways. But I've spoken to many people who feel that if presented with a choice between two options, God will always want them to take the one that will make them least happy. That somehow that's intrinsically the more spiritual choice, right? And this is a theology that views true obedience as doing only those things which you'd rather not do. As if self-denial is itself a virtuous thing, in itself, intrinsically, self-denial is good. If we make choices that lead to our enjoyment or pleasure, our motivation for obedience is tainted somehow, and we we're simply acting out of self-interest. So that somehow disqualifies things we might be doing that are actually, that we experience positively. And another way of putting it is that we can only be sure of our genuine motivations if we obey God against all our inclinations and desires. And at the expense of our happiness. Now, this is an extreme way of stating it, but I feel like probably many of us have grown up in situations that in one way or another have implied this. Even if you haven't heard these direct words coming from the pulpit or whatever, there's this some kind of assumption, unspoken assumption, that if you're really spiritual, you're going to follow God's call to the thing you least want to do. And I think this is nonsense. It is true that God calls us to things that are difficult and that scare us and that maybe don't make us uncomfortable. But there's all kinds of ways in which this is a mistake if we think it's intrinsically spiritual. It's an inaccurate view of God. It's a terrible view of God's guidance that leads us into making a lot of terrible decisions. It leads us to suspect our own desires as if they're always corrupt and always leading us astray, which is not the case. In fact, it's really, in large part, our desire that leads us to seek God. And C.S. Lewis points this out in the very beginning of his Weight of Glory sermon. He talks about this attitude is more an influence of Kant than it is of the Bible. This is the way in which sort of this Stoic thinking that comes into the Christian faith. It doesn't really come from the Bible. The thing that I think is saddest about this attitude is that it misses out on one of the Bible's central teachings about reality, and that is, as we strive to live according to God's commands, we're living according to our design. We're actually living the way we were made to be. And so there's every reason to expect that an obedient life will be a flourishing life. Right? We thrive as we seek to rightly honor God. There's a causal connection between striving to obey the God who made us and loves us and thriving. And if we ignore that, then our faith and our Christian life will be very withered and not true to God's own revelation. And of course, I've already hinted at this, but whenever you say something like this, you have to add caveats. This does not mean that in every case, if we obey God, our lives will become easier and happier. Of course not. It does mean, though, in general, peace and wholeness and joy and stability and all these good things, they're so, sort of presented as logical consequences of following the one who made us. Of course you will thrive. If you read the book of Proverbs, it's full of these kinds of things. It doesn't mean that just there's always a one-to-one correlation. If you obey God, then you'll be blessed in this way. No. But it does mean that in general, as we strive to live a certain way of life in obedience to God, we will thrive. Basically because we're doing what we were made to do. Second caveat, it also does not mean that the Christian faith will never require us to sacrifice or make decisions that make us sad. Sometimes they make us sad because of our own sin. We have to give up things that we probably shouldn't be desiring. But often Christ will call us to take up our cross and deny ourselves. But it won't be because suffering is intrinsically a great thing to do. Rather, it's because suffering is sometimes the necessary thing in order to follow Christ. It's the following of Christ which is the point. In order to follow him, we may be required to pick up our cross. Not because carrying the cross is intrinsically a good thing to do, but following Christ is. So all this is to say that we actually, again, I've said this several times, among other things, we were made to be happy. So, when Adam and Eve were created and placed in the garden to work and to tend it, to care for it and to subdue it, to be fruitful and multiply on the earth, and in the pre-fallen context, to do it all in a loving and secure relationship with each other and to God. There was a perfect and a whole happiness, a thick happiness, you could say, a happiness that went all the way down into every aspect of humanity, There was a rightness and a wholesomeness of every aspect of human life. Happiness, because of the connotations connected to the word happiness today, the word happiness sounds too thin for what I'm trying to describe. And I don't know whether we should replace it with a different word or whether we should just infuse richer meaning into the word. That's a topic of conversation we could have. But something that has often bothered me about Genesis 1, 27, I think it's 27. Anyway, Genesis 1, it is often referred to as the cultural mandate. As if it was primarily a command that Adam and Eve should obey from a sense of duty. This is the go, be fruitful and multiply, rule over the birds of the air. And rightly, this is sort of God's stamp of approval on human culture. Go out and make culture. Go out and observe and experiment and explore and make something new out of the world I've given you. So this is, but to view it just as a mandate is misleading, because it's a blessing and it's parallel with all the other blessings that God gives over His creation. He blessed them saying, go be fruitful and multiply. And if you think about it, what he's telling them to do, he's telling them to go and do the very thing he's made them to do, and that they're probably at this point longing to do with all their all their might. Go out into this beautiful world, explore it, invent things, have a lot of sex, raise children, tend to and rule over everything that they were made to do. It's clearly a blessing, and it's clearly something that gives them a deep joy. And they're doing it in the context of a relationship with God, who they know and trust and love and loves them. And to call it just a mandate is a bit of a, again, a shriveling of the true sense of what's going on there. In any case, after the fall, the broken relationship with God was the source of all the other brokenness that we see. So the crucial central relationship was fractured between humans and God, and the fall brought many things that are out of our control that threaten happiness, right? All kinds of things that happen to us are not directly a result of our sin, but we also became sinners, and there are millions of reasons or ways in which our sin robs others and ourselves of this sort of deep, thick happiness. We're also, I'll add, because of the fall, we're confused about happiness, too. We don't even know what's good for us anymore. We think we know what's good for us, but we don't. We think we know what we need, but we don't. We think we know what will make us happy, but we don't. We don't even know ourselves. That's what gets us into... That's actually what maybe something like the core of this modern confusion about happiness, that we just utterly don't understand ourselves or know ourselves. We're estranged from God, from others, and ourselves. Now, happiness adrift. Remember my original metaphor of a boat that's not anchored and it's not really under control and it's just sort of floating adrift. And amid all the confusing and conflicting messages about happiness that we've been talking about, I think there's a common thread that runs through it all. Or you could say maybe there's a common foundation underneath it all. And this is on the level of presupposition, on the level of just something that's assumed to be true and doesn't even have to be articulated. It's that the individual is autonomous. That happiness can only be found in the context of unlimited personal freedom. And that's a crucial idea to everything I'm trying to get at tonight. Autonomy of the individual is the basic foundation under contemporary views of happiness, almost without exception, I think. So what is this autonomous happiness? What do I mean? Well, autonomous means self-law, basically. Laws and rules invented by the self for the self. So to say that individuals are autonomous means everyone is free to make up their own rules for themselves. And again, this is a foundational assumption, I think, in a lot of Western culture, in America particularly. What this means is that it's up to each person to define what happiness is for themselves. What is it? No one can define happiness for you. That's the what of happiness, the ontological question. What even is it? You know, you as the autonomous individual get to define it for yourself. Nobody, don't let anybody tell you what happiness is. You're the one that gets to decide for yourself. And it also means, and this is very related, it also means that each person has to make their own life decisions that will help them reach the goal of happiness as defined by them. So it means that no one else can tell you what you should do, what kind of life you should live, what are the ingredients or the steps towards happiness that you should take. That's a path that only you should be deciding for yourself. That's kind of the how of happiness. How do you go about getting it? And that is equally under this idea of autonomy and freedom of the person. So the world is filled with individuals, each with their own self-defined life goal and self-defined means of attaining it. And notice that the why of happiness is not really addressed. The question of whether there is a particular purpose to it beyond itself is often unanswered. And well, I'll talk more about this later, but if happiness is the highest goal and purpose in life, then the point of happiness is happiness. What's the purpose of something that's the highest goal? Well, that's kind of a non-starter. We pursue happiness because we want to be happy. End of story. People look at you like you're stupid if you ask them why they want to be happy. You ever asked anybody that? I've never asked anybody that. What's so great about this happiness thing, Andrew? Why do you want to be happy? It's considered self-evident that happiness is a value in itself. It needs no justification at all. So this is the core doctrine, I think, that underlines it all. The core doctrine that underlines it all is autonomy and freedom. So this is one of the reasons why contemporary happiness is a chaotic mess, right? Because the doctrine of personal autonomy is held by a lot of different persons, right? And each with the freedom to define what happiness is for him or herself, and with less and less unifying common moral ground. You have a deep conviction that everybody gets to decide what happiness is for themselves, and a decreasing number of unifying structures in society or unifying morals in society, and it gets more and more chaotic. And so much of the pain we cause each other is a result of conflicting happinesses. That's not a word. And the word was underlined red on my computer screen. I had to override it. It's like, I mean happinesses. The pain we cause each other is so often the result of conflicting happinesses. So, just one example. Think of romantic relationships or even marriages. If someone is not meeting what you perceive as your needs, if you see what you think is an opportunity for greater happiness elsewhere, the conventional wisdom today says, move on. Your happiness is too important. Don't squander your happiness. So the doctrine of autonomous happiness legitimizes many people's restlessness, lack of contentment, lust for novelty, even their adulterous desires, I think, for people today. This happiness is absolute autonomy. Happiness is personal freedom. It's a way of legitimizing something which is actually a real vice in many of us, which is just this lust for something new. And I'm just bored with this life I have. I'm bored with my spouse. I'm bored with my friends. I need to move on and find something else cooler or more satisfying somehow. And if I believe that it's my own responsibility to just find happiness however I choose to define it, then there's very little to stop me from just really taking advantage of people in any number of different ways. So meanwhile, if your spouse has just left you, you know, your vision of happiness might have been quite different. Your vision of happiness might have been all about security and trust and a long-term commitment. Too bad your ex-wife or ex-husband vision of happiness was about novelty and excitement, and you know, so there's no happy end to this kind of story if both people view their own autonomy as the foundation for happiness. This is just a little example, right? But this is, you can see this blown up in a million different ways. Autonomous happinesses that equals conflict and equals pain and equals people really abusing each other, taking advantage of each other. And just basically relinquishing any sense of responsibility to one another. So, the world becomes an increasingly perilous place the more each person commits to their own self-defined happiness. With no commonly held standards of life to hem in each person's pursuit of happiness, people destroy each other. And then we see, as this sort of gets worse in our culture, with the government, which used to be able to rely on a basic shared system of morality and decency among people, now has to enact stricter and more detailed laws to compensate for this loss. So the government steps in and creates more and more legislation because there's not any commonly held view of what is right and wrong and decent anymore. And if there is, it's a residual kind of leftover result of the Judeo-Christian worldview, but that so many people don't hold anymore. So it's on the way out. And I think the sad thing is that most people would probably concede that quality relationships with other people are an essential part of happiness, right? And yet, because everyone is committed to seeking their own version of happiness, relationships are often the cause of the deepest pain we ever experience in life, right? Failed relationships. So, I mean, very few people would say quality relationships have nothing to do with happiness, right? Most people would say quality of my relationships with other people are a really important part of what being happy is, right? And yet that very thing is under threat when we think happiness is autonomous. So, for the autonomy at the root of happiness, I think we can, for illustrations, turn to Walt Disney. And for those of you who have been to many lectures over the years, I apologize for I'm just going to talk a little bit about the movie Frozen, just for a second. If I must, I must.
You can sing?
Yeah, I was thinking of singing the song, Let It Go. I'll sing one line of the right, yeah. But the story, it actually has a whole shape of the movie. It has quite an interesting narrative. But what's the moment that sells the movie? What's the moment that makes every kid like want to be in the story? And anybody?
Forget your family, run away.
The song. The song, right? Let it go. That's the moment that sells the song. Even though the actual story contradicts what the song is saying, absolutely, because you can't have a happy story that ends with "Let It Go," because it's basically isolation and total alienation of these two sisters and the kingdom cast into a winter in which everyone will eventually starve and die and all this stuff. You know, you can't end a Disney movie that way. So you have to patch it up somehow, but the song Let It Go was used to sell the movie in a different way because of how appealing that is. Just cast it all off. Screw everybody. Do what makes you happy. And who cares if you're in total isolation? That's the way to be free. You know, that's what the song is all about. So anyway, there's a line in the song that says it's time to, so she has this power where she can sort of freeze everything around her and her whole life it's been a thing of shame. So she's been sort of sequestered her whole life and her parents don't want anyone to find out that she has this power because it's a dangerous thing. She actually has hurt her sister and so she's kind of in quarantine. But then at the day of her coronation, by accident, she snaps and she just, this power is unleashed. Now everybody knows and she runs away. So there's this, it's a sad life, but the moment of Let It Go is when she finally realizes that I can finally be myself. I don't have to pretend anything anymore. And there is a, I think, a legitimate appeal to that moment, I think, it connected with a lot of people. So, anyway, as she's beginning to cast off the fetters of her, the words her parents have always told her, she says, "It's time to see what I can do. To test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free." See? Woo! The first time I saw that movie, I had no idea what I was getting into. I'm like, oh, there's this movie, Frozen. My mother-in-law and my two daughters went to this, and I, at that moment when she says, "No right, no wrong, no rules for me," I was just like, I was shocked deeply disturbed, because it was clear that like this, I was supposed to experience this as this great cathartic moment of celebration, right? And I was like, holy, what is going on here? Restrictions on freedom are thought to be the main source of human unhappiness, yep. Right? Any restriction on your freedom, whether it's commitment to your family, in her case, commitment and responsibility to her kingdom, anything that would restrict your total freedom is the source of unhappiness. And her whole life, she's been told to conceal, don't feel. And so she quotes that to herself again. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. A little lower register. Sorry. That's all. But this moment of no right, no wrong, no rules for me, I'm free. That's what autonomy is. This is basically like a pretty much word-for-word definition of what autonomy is. And it's connected to being free. And the cold never bothered me anyway. That's her line. And she slams the door on the world, basically. And meanwhile, her kingdom is freezing to death down somewhere. You know. Anyway, you may have noticed that what I'm describing in all of this is like a ship without an anchor. Okay, this is the ship that's floating without anything to tie it down. It's a seascape in which everybody's in their own boat with no anchor, deciding what happiness is for themselves, crashing into each other, wrecking on the rocks, getting swept out to sea, drifting aimlessly, and occasionally, you know, hitting other boats that are equally adrift, equally autonomous. So I want to look at one of the more, I think, thoughtful versions of contemporary happiness coming from within the positive psychology movement. And so this is, up until now, I've been just talking about almost just commonly held attitudes that people have. But this is someone who's actually thought a lot about happiness. He's a psychologist, and he's written a lot. I won't give too much preamble, but his name is Tal Ben Shahar.
He looks happy.
What's that?
He looks happy.
He's a happy. Yeah, he's happy. He's rather than surveying lots and lots of people who have written on happiness, because there's a lot of literature within the positive psychology movement on happiness. I chose this one person as just sort of an example because he's a professor at Harvard University in the psychology department. He has written extensively on happiness. These are just a couple of his books. Happier, even happier. But he taught a course on happiness, which in the space of a couple years became the best attended course ever at Harvard University. It's yet to be topped in terms of attendance. And he's sort of a guru on happiness. He gets interviewed and does TED Talks and all these things. So anyway, he's one way into this conversation that's going on in the world of positive psychology. Martin Seligman, who's considered the founder of the positive psychology movement. There's a lot of psychologists who came earlier that were forerunners, but in 1995 that term was coined by Seligman, and he calls positive psychology the science of happiness. And it came about when Seligman and others noticed, sort of with dismay, that the vast majority of psychological research that was being done was in the area of pathology. So, in other words, the emphasis was on studying the causes of people's psychological problems and brokenness and dysfunction. What is it that caused this? What's going on in the schizophrenic? What's going on in the any number of different things? People suffering with extreme anxiety. Seligman and many others since have tried to address this imbalance by focusing their research on what contributes to a person's positive psychological state. So that's where the term positive psychology comes from. What is it that makes a psychologically healthy, well-adjusted, responsible, socially adept person function? How do those people work? And what is it that makes people happy, after all? That's one of the main questions of positive psychology. Lots of studies have been done since then along these lines. So what are the psychological benefits of practicing gratitude, for instance? That's one of the most studied topics in the realm of positive psychology. What are the positive psychological fruits of forgiveness? That's another one. It's quite amazing how many crucial Christian virtues are now discovered to be good for us, right? And so this has been an area of a lot of interesting and fruitful work. I think there's a lot to applaud in the positive psychology movement as Christians. There's also a lot of things to question, I think. But I often chuckle that, you know, lo and behold, virtues that the Bible has exhorted us to practice for two millennia are now shown to be good for us. So now it's okay to says the research. But it's a great opportunity, actually, to get into really good conversations with people who are reading this kind of literature, actually, because it's, you know, why is it that it's good for us? Those questions aren't often answered beyond a very reductionistic neurological explanation. So, one contemporary positive psychologist, this guy, Tal Ben-Shahar, he's an Israeli, and I want to present some of his ideas, mostly because of how influential he's been. And he has something, it's sort of funny, this is, he has something called the hamburger model of happiness. And it seems really trivial at first, but that's not my hand, that's a hand model, probably. Yeah, it's a nice hand. Anyway, so I'm just going to explain this. It comes across as being a little goofy at first, but then it's an interesting way into the whole conversation about happiness. So, the horizontal axis has to do with the present moment, and the vertical axis has to do with the future. In the present moment, along the horizontal axis, the far left is detriment. Over here. The far right is benefit. Things that are harmful in the present, things that are of benefit in the present. And then along the vertical axis, the future, future detriment is at the bottom, future benefit is at the top. So the whole question is, what is the ideal hamburger? And there's four quadrants, and I'll leave the best for last. So number one, that's the top left. In the top left quadrant, you have an extremely healthy hamburger. I know that there's maybe a veggie burger of some kind or something. I'm not sure. This burger is good for you, but it tastes like cardboard. That's not the case about all veggie burgers. I'm not trying to say that, but it's good for you, but it leaves a lot to be desired in terms of how it actually tastes. In other words, it has a future benefit, which is it's healthy, right? But very little benefit to you in the present, in the way of pleasure. Tal Ben-Shahar calls this the rat race model of happiness. He says, it's the mindset that I will sacrifice momentary benefits in the present, sacrifice pleasures in the present for the sake of some future good. Or something that I perceive as a future good. So I will get very little sleep, I'll pursue none of my hobbies and the things that I love, I'll spend very little time with my family in order to amass as much wealth as I can in the future. And I'll benefit from that in the future. The scale of benefit tips towards the future, and actually happiness is located in the future, right? So I'm making all kinds of sacrifices now in the way of pleasure for this thing out there. The harder you work now, the more pleasures you forego now, the bigger the payday of happiness someday. The problem with this, he points out, is despite having a very good work ethic, you might actually be miserable in the present. You may neglect daily pleasures and daily responsibilities that would actually add to your happiness, including time with your family. You'll get overworked and stressed, and at the end of the day, find that the payload was not all it was cracked up to be. So when you finally achieve what you think was going to make you happy, you feel like there must have been something else. And this is, you hear people talk about this all the time. I finally realized my dream, and I was depressed the next day. You know, what's going on? There's this sense of being cheated. There's this sense that happiness is just around the next corner. I need to try for some even more strenuous goal, some greater achievement. There's this horrifying moment. I'm not going to give you a direct quote, but in the Screwtape letters, it's talking about a man who didn't really obey God, but also sort of didn't really enjoy anything either in life. He wasn't a spectacular enough sinner to really go and do anything really fun, right? So he was kind of, anyway, he gets to hell and says, "I now realize I did neither what I ought nor what I enjoyed." And it's just this horrible, horrible, you know, I didn't actually behave morally or obey God in any way. Neither did I do things that I liked. I got cheated out of everything, right? Or cheated myself out of everything. So that's the rat race mentality, which I think is many people's view of how to achieve happiness, right? The bottom right, this is the burger in which there, which is delicious, but terrible for you. So with this burger, there's tremendous benefits in the present, but only detriment in the future. So you'll have to work out extra hard the next day to compensate for it. If you ate this burger every day for a year, you'd probably die of a heart attack. So all the benefit is in the present moment, no benefit in the future. And he calls this the hedonistic model of happiness. In other words, happiness consists of seeking momentary pleasures after momentary pleasure again and again and again to try to maintain this kind of level or thrill or whatever. So this is a picture of sort of restlessly trying to scratch an itch, finding a thrill or comfort in the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. The problem is that pleasure in the present does not last very long. It doesn't produce lasting happiness. So we get bored very quickly, we get complacent, we get used to things, and we move on to the next thing. And so it's short-lived, it requires constant novelty, whether it's novelty of purchases, novelty in sexual relationships, novelty even in sexual identity, places to travel, languages to learn, substances to ingest. There's not really too much thought of the future, it's all about what I can achieve right now in terms of hedonistic pleasure. In the bottom left, we have the burger that is both tastes terrible and is terrible for you. And so he describes this as nihilism. There's no benefits of any kind, present or future. And this is basically the person that's given up on the whole idea of happiness and is just kind of utterly complacent. And but finally, the top right, we have the ideal hamburger, which is delicious and good for you. So there are benefits in the present and in the future. And this is what he calls happiness. So experiencing pleasure in the moment, but also having a sense of the purpose because of a positive future impact that this moment is having. So his main thesis is to say that happiness requires both present benefit and future benefit. He calls the present benefit pleasure. So this enjoyment in the moment, and he calls the future benefit meaning. And so you have this scenario, true happiness equals pleasure plus meaning. And he goes to great lengths to explain why you need both, not just one or the other. He admits that he's dealing with very general categories, so no one person fits neatly into any one of these hamburger categories. Very often we live in different quadrants at different times or in different areas of our life. So he's just using this as a model or a starting place for understanding some of what he's trying to say. Now, I think there are a lot of helpful things about this model, particularly in how he identifies the inadequate ways of seeking happiness. This is similar to the documentary we watched. Dick had commented that it was quite helpful in unmasking false views of happiness, ways in which we chase after happiness that actually won't deliver. It was quite good at that. But it didn't have as much to offer in terms of, well, what actually, what actually is it, and how can we seek it? So I feel the same way about this guy's argument. I think he unmasked some unhelpful views of happiness, and I agree with that those things are inadequate. Particularly the sort of the hedonistic treadmill kind of going on to the next and the next and the next thing to try to just scratch this itch. It's also significant that he identifies the need for meaning as important, as something that's essential to what it is to be a human, to have meaning for what we do, not just momentary pleasure. And he really argues strongly that without this sense of meaning, there's no such thing as being truly happy. And I think that's true. But there are also a lot of problems with Tal Ben Shahar's conception of happiness. And I find the concept of meaning to be one of them. His definition of meaning is very, very thin and insufficient, I think. Having awareness of a future benefit for what you're doing, it can give you a sense of significance for what you're doing, but it's incredibly open-ended. It does not necessarily curb the ruthless pursuit of wealth at all. If sort of the cutthroat competitive corporate life is what gives someone pleasure, which it does for many people, sort of throwing their weight around and being a powerful person in an office, you know, if that gives you a momentary pleasure, but also connects you with the sense of purpose and meaning in the future because you're making a ton of money and someday you're going to retire and buy a yacht, then there's, under his definition, this is happiness, right? You've arrived. So within his model, this sort of ruthless business person who enjoys feeling powerful every day at work and doesn't really want to spend time with his family anyway and is always conscious of the growing pile of money that he's going to enjoy someday, if this person is truly happy, he's arrived. You know, really? Even if this is true about happiness, what is the cost to the people around you? So he defines meaning as simply an awareness of future benefit, and he sort of assumes that people will have noble and unselfish motives in the present and the future. So I think he overlooks the real possibility that some people will find pleasure in cruelty and domination of others. Pleasure in the moment. I mean, so he doesn't have a robust doctrine of sin. And so he has no real framework for critiquing sin. Meaning, in this sense, is not heavy enough to truly ground anyone morally. And so there's this moral vacuum in what he's describing. At the root of his thesis, there's still the autonomy of the individual. Absolutely. The individual is still completely autonomous to decide what happiness means for them. Meaning is something that is self-defined. You decide what meaning is. You decide. Only you can decide what gives you a sense of meaning. So the individual creates meaning by projecting it onto some part of life and then expects that thing that they created to give them meaning as from above. So this is, for more on this whole topic, I'd recommend some of Dick's lectures that he's done on meaning, on how finding meaning without God, essentially, is finding, projecting meaning onto something that's less significant than ourselves and then trying to have that very thing give us meaning. Which is, I think it's an example you've used about it. It's a bit like composing your own exam, knowing all the answers, taking the exam, getting it 100%, and pretending that it means something. Right? No, you made that thing. It does not give you meaning from above. So I'm left wondering, is there any moral component to happiness at all in his conception here? The image that comes to mind is the ship that drops the anchor chain without an anchor on it, right? So the captain has the right idea. He realizes that the ship can't just be drifting around. He knows he has to keep the ship from crashing into other boats and into the shore. But the chain is much too light and there's no way to grip the bottom. So the boat is still adrift. Maybe a little more slowly than it would be drifting otherwise, but it's still drifting. And there's a false sense of security that comes with this sort of light sense of meaning. We're connecting happiness with meaning, but it's not connected to anything that will hold it in place. It's just dragging a chain along the bottom. So Tal Ben Shahar goes on to argue, and I'll quote him at length here. He goes on to argue that happiness, this combination of pleasure and meaning, is the ultimate currency. What he means is that happiness is the true purpose and goal of life. And I'll give you a sense. I didn't have the time to actually include any of this on my screen here, so I apologize because it'd be helpful to look on. But I'll just read a variety of excerpts from this book. He says, "When the question is, why do you want to be happy? The answer is simple and definitive. We pursue happiness because it is in our natures to do so. When the answer to a question is, because it makes me happy, nothing can challenge the validity and finality of that answer. Happiness is the highest on the hierarchy of goals, the end toward which all other ends lead." He says later on, "If we want to assess the worth of a business, we would use money as our means of measurement. We would calculate the dollar value of its assets and liabilities, profits and losses. Everything that could not be translated into monetary terms would not increase or decrease the business's value. In this case, in measuring a company's worth, money is the ultimate currency. A human being, like a business, makes profits and suffers losses. For a human being, however, the ultimate currency is not money, nor is it any external measure of fame, fortune, or power. The ultimate currency for a human being is happiness." And then he goes on, this is a little bit later, by translating money, conversations, or anything else for that matter, into the currency of happiness. So it's almost like you look at any decision, anything in your life out there, and you need to bring it to the bureau to change at the airport and trade it in for happiness. Decide how much happiness will this thing yield. What's the exchange rate, basically? That's the image he's using. So this is how we should make all of our decisions. That's the idea he's working with here. So by translating money, conversations, or anything else for that matter, into the currency of happiness, through evaluating how happy something makes us, we have a common currency that enables us to compare seemingly unrelated experiences. So this is how you decide whether it's better to have a rich relationship with your family or make a ton of money and neglect your family. This is how you decide. You discern which one of those will make you more happy, and then you go with that. Right? Happiness is the ultimate currency in which a human being is paid, and thus the currency that matters. Happiness should be the determinant of our actions, the goal towards which all other goals lead. End quote. So, this means that all life decisions should be made by weighing what will yield the most happiness. And he uses that term over and over. What yields the most happiness? What else would you base your decisions on? It's fascinating. He doesn't actually say this, but he as good as says, what does it profit a person that he gain the whole world but forfeit their happiness? That's essentially what he's saying, without saying it. Nothing else matters. Nothing else is of significance except your own happiness. Any decision you make, your own happiness has to be the deciding factor. And he speaks of happiness in much the same way that Jesus talks about the pearl of great price, right? Which is this thing that's so valuable. You sell everything you have. You sacrifice everything you have to gain it, and it's still worth it. Right, that's Jesus talking about our salvation. He's talking about our relationship to God through Him. It is so valuable; it's worth sacrificing everything you have to get it, and it's still worth it. And so that's how Tal Ben-Shahar is talking about happiness. So, is there a problem with this? Again, the problem of morality just rears its head. If happiness is the deciding factor as we evaluate choices in life, there's nothing really to prevent me from walking all over other people, as long as it makes me happy. So you can sort of tell that in this book he wants to be able to assert that to have meaningful, loving relationships is intrinsically better than making lots of money. He wants to say that, but he can't really say that. All he can say is that, statistically speaking, studies show that, rich relationships are more likely to make you happy, right? But he can't say it's better to love people than to make tons of money. He can't say it because he doesn't have the moral foundation to say it. So, first of all, that assertion that rich, meaningful relationships will make you happier than making tons of money might actually not even be true for everybody. That's one thing. Secondly, his perspective, I think, reduces all my potentially good and moral choices, like caring for a hurting friend, He reduces that, all of that, to what it can do for me. So he says nothing about the intrinsic moral goodness of caring for others. It's just the right thing. You know, he doesn't say anything about that. Rather, we should care for others because it will make us happier. Or as long as it will make us happier. So this ultimate currency idea is pretty sinister in my mind because of what it displaces as other valid currencies, right? Only happiness has intrinsic value, he says. Other things are only means to happiness. So insofar as this will lead to happiness, it has value, but it doesn't have intrinsic value. So the end result is total self-obsession, I think, which maybe this is the inevitable result of having the foundation for happiness be autonomy, right? Every decision you make is just based on what will make me more happy. So what I want to know is there a conception of happiness that's available to people in the worst circumstances? Is happiness even the right word to use? And this is maybe an open question for the discussion time. Is there any happiness available to people suffering unjustly in jail? Is there any happiness available to people with debilitating illnesses? Is there any happiness available for people living below the poverty line, or people in the thick of loss and grief, when there's neither pleasure in the present, neither any sense that what they're doing now means anything in their future? Think of someone suffering unjustly in jail. What's in this model? What's available for them? Is there anything left for them? No, not within this model. A lot of what he's saying assumes a certain quality of life, right? So, if this is happiness that's dragging an anchor chain along the bottom, what would re-anchored happiness be? I'll go back to this picture here, I'm gonna sort of blast through some of this just because I think it's getting late, and I want to not say too many things that will be said tomorrow. So, come back tomorrow. It's worth noting, I think, that the church has embraced its own version of this commitment to personal happiness as an ultimate good. So the bad theology we were talking about earlier, that somehow God is only happy if I'm sad, that's not the only mistake. You can fall off both sides of a roof here, and the church has at different times. A number of years ago, I think 2005, Christian Smith and Melinda Denton, who are sociologists, wrote this book, Soul Searching: The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers. So he's doing sort of a sociology of religion study. They coined this term, moralistic therapeutic deism. Moralistic therapeutic deism. And it's gotten a lot of attention since this came out. And it's this term that should get a lot of attention because it's quite sobering. But it was his way, that phrase was his way of sort of summarizing his findings. This is sort of the quality of faith that we're finding in young Christians today in America. Young Christians, by and large, believed that the most important thing was to be a good person, to be nice, to try really hard, to be unselfish. That's the moralistic part. They believed that God's top priority was to ensure their happiness. God just wants you to be happy. That's the therapeutic aspect of it. They also believed in a God who was distant from their everyday concerns and did not demand much attention or obedience, especially in ways that they didn't want to change. In terms of daily decisions, that's the distant, deistic God. He's there when I want him to make me happy, but he's not going to demand much of me. And then, finally, good people go to heaven. So it's just about behaving well. God wants me to be happy. He's not going to interfere in my life. And that was sort of the level of depth that this guy found in a lot of the people he interviewed. So this is, again, a description of a very shallow faith, sort of a barely Christianized version of the surrounding culture. My happiness is not only my priority, but it's God's priority too, right? That's great. But it says, I mean, it's not these young people's fault necessarily. This is the level of Christianity being taught to them somehow, or the inability to critique the culture around us. So Joshua and David and I have been struggling, I think, to sift through a lot of these contemporary ideas about happiness. And our goal has been try to arrive at a thoughtful biblical response and a biblical alternative. And it's been way harder than I thought it would be. It's been confusing, and we've had a lot of conversations. I'm going to give some hints tonight, and my colleagues will just make it all clear tomorrow as they delve deeper into what biblical happiness actually is. But I'll say a few things. As Christians, I think we find ourselves in a grand story. If we believe what the Bible teaches about the world and about us and about God, we belong in a story. God made us and knows better than anyone why we exist and what we're for. And he knows better than any of us what it takes for us to truly thrive, right? He's the one that made us. So he's remained faithful to us throughout the long history of our rebellion. He has showed his depth of his love by sending his son, by coming himself to redeem us, and by sending his spirit at Pentecost to live in us and with us in the church. So he's also promised a final resolution to the story, which is the fulfillment of all the good promises that he's made and a final undoing of this curse. So the story extends into our past, and it's relevant right now in our present, and it extends into our future. And we find ourselves now sort of in the middle of it somewhere. In response to this story, God calls us to worship him in everything we do and to strive to imitate his son, Jesus Christ. So this takes place, all of this takes place in a fallen world in which Christians are not immune from pain and struggle. And not immune from sin, too. So much of the pain and struggle we experience is our own doing. So, but it is in a world which is also full of beauty and goodness and truth. There are many things that point us to God's truth, despite the brokenness that we see. So, as we anticipate a final fulfillment of God's plans, there's work for us to do. It's meaningful work. It will be hard work, and at times discouraging work. But it's not in vain. It's not in vain because God is with us. It's not in vain because God is coming back, and everything we do unto God right now has value because of the future he's promised. So if there's any such thing as Christian happiness, it has to be in reference to this particular story. And it's not simple. It's not a matter of taking some contemporary version of happiness and tweaking it a little bit and making it Christian. Happiness is still significant, but it's a radically different thing than what we've been reflecting on tonight. Happiness is not dependent on any one thing. The secret is not to be found in community alone, or in nature alone, or in meaningful work, or pursuing our hobbies alone. It has to do with the entire shape of our life. The Hebrew word for shalom is what comes to mind, which is this very rich word that has to do with holistic well-being, an experience of God's blessing in every aspect of our humanity, a holistic peace and flourishing. And one of the things that this whole, you know, again, if there's such a thing as Christian happiness, it begins with acknowledging that we are not autonomous, right? What we've been talking about all evening is the autonomy of the individual, the absolute freedom, you know. Absolute freedom is not the secret to happiness. We are not absolutely free. Neither should we think we're absolutely free. Neither should we strive to be absolutely free. I am not... If you just think the implications of this for everything we've been talking about are huge. I am not totally free to define happiness for myself. I don't get to just make up what it is. I'm not totally free to decide for myself what way of life will make me happy. No matter what strong opinions they may have on the subject. Happiness will not be about constructing my own reality and constructing my own identity. It will be a result, really, of responding well to realities that are outside myself. So I don't, you know, there is this notion that to be happy, we construct reality. We construct a situation in which is pleasing to me. No, in a Christian sense, we need to be thinking more about how do we respond well to realities that are just there, that are the case outside of our own heads. Realities about the world and its brokenness and its goodness, realities about God, realities about myself. I will need to submit to things that are true if I'm going to be happy in a Christian sense. So there's a moral element to this, to our lives. There are life choices that are right and difficult. There are life choices that are wrong and easy. And these difficult choices very often are actually to our benefit, absolutely. It doesn't mean that I'm not saying that every difficult choice is the right one, but even in the Ten Commandments, which begins with, I am the Lord your God that rescued you from Egypt, the house of slavery, the land of slavery. That's how the Ten Commandments begins. And then everything that follows is God essentially saying, okay, here's how you live to stay free. I have freed you, and this way of living is the way you should live if you want to stay free in this deeper sense. Jesus says, happy are those who mourn, sometimes translated, blessed are those who mourn, and Joshua will be talking more about this tomorrow. In other words, it is good in God's eyes for us to respond appropriately to the brokenness of the world, including the brokenness we see in ourselves. That's God's response to it too. So grieving at our sin, grieving at suffering, grieving at the brokenness of the world. We're actually happy when we grieve that. So clearly this happiness is a different sort of thing, right? And I'll let Joshua explain that tomorrow. Blessed. It has to do with aligning ourselves with the truth. Rather than happiness as the ultimate goal of life, the main purpose of life, faithfulness is life's goal. To be faithful. And yet to say faithfulness is the ultimate currency puts too much weight on our own righteousness, I think. I would want to say maybe the ultimate currency is God's grace. That's the ultimate currency. What actually is the sign of human life well lived. Whatever happiness we enjoy, I think, will be the fruit of seeking to be faithful. If our ultimate goal is to seek happiness and sacrifice everything to that, we are on the road of autonomous happiness, and we will fail. It will be miserable for us and other people. But happiness is something that I think we can experience as we strive for faithfulness. If you think about it, I won't even read the whole passage, but Jesus' words in Matthew 6, where he talks about, seek ye first the kingdom of God. He's talking about anxiety, about all the things we worry about. And he says, stop worrying. Let tomorrow worry about itself. God knows you need things. Seek the kingdom of God first, and these other things will be added to you. So all of our Christian striving and this idea of faithfulness as life's goal takes place in the context of knowing we are already known, already accepted, already loved based on what Jesus Christ has done for us. So if it's going to be Christian happiness, an awareness of God's grace, and a deep, both intellectual and experiential confidence that you are loved by God, you personally, not just humanity, you know, in general, but you personally. This is an essential ingredient to Christian happiness, if there is such a thing. This has to be part of it, right? This internal grasping of grace as it applies to you personally. And this is an area in which a lot of Christians are unhappy. You know, you may believe all the correct doctrine, but don't really think it applies to you, and don't really connect God's love to your own failures, right? And your own. I mean, this is a huge thing. And so, this is a description, I think, of an anchored ship. It's not adrift, smacking into rocks and other boats. It can occupy a circle of space based on the length of that chain, right? So it's not totally fixed in one point. It has room to float, but there's parameters. And it can revolve around that central point, which is the anchor. And this might be viewed as a limitation, but it's the only safe way to be. In relationship to God, we actually have meaning because God is the one who made us. He's the one that's above us and has given us meaning. We didn't make him and then are trying to force him to give us meaning. It's appropriate that we look to God for meaning. The one who made us and knows why we were made. And because of how God made us, I think there are various different things in life that will be ingredients to thriving. Ingredients. No one of these things is the key to happiness, but an experience of dominion. This idea that we as human beings affect the world around us. We can do something and the world will change as a result. And this includes things we do for our own happiness. This is not a bad thing. If I want to go on vacation with my family because that'll be happy for all of us, I may save money for a while in order to do that. There's nothing wrong with that. Exercising my dominion to make my life richer and better, and the life of my family. Fulfilling work. Exercising our creativity. Relationships and community. Being part of a body of believers. Worshiping corporately. Engaging with creation. These are all aspects of how we've been made, and these are all aspects of what human thriving would look like. But because we live in a fallen world, not everyone has access to these ingredients now. So it's almost like these are ingredients for a recipe, but none of us are working in a fully stocked kitchen, right? We're all going to be dealing with some imperfect version of what human thriving is. These are all aspects of what will, I think, be redeemed someday. So I think that's where I'm going to end. I'll end with this one image of, and maybe this will be a way of leading into Sarah's poem and then our discussion. I'm conscious that we haven't really talked much about joy and happiness and what's the difference if there is one. But a passage in Genesis, which is really striking, is the story of Joseph, who is basically mugged by his brothers, sold as a slave. They tell his father that he's dead. He's hauled away to Egypt, and then he's thrown in jail for trying to do the right thing. And then it says, and the Lord was with him. And so you just think about, to the contemporary person who kind of swallows this, all these notions of happiness, this just sounds like the biggest nonsense you've ever, what do you mean the Lord was with him? Everything's gone wrong in his life, you know, everything. He tried to do the right thing and he got stabbed in the back, and here he is, but the Lord was with him. And so there is a very rich and deep biblical idea of the blessing of the Lord being much, not at all reducible to just nice things happening to us. God being with him. And I think this is a hint as to what actual joy is. joy, which is, it is, I think, less based on life circumstances than happiness. It's an awareness of gift. One Christian psychologist has said, joy is happiness plus gratitude. This is awareness. I'm not sure I would say that, but this is the awareness that everything you have is a gift. And even if you're in the moment of suffering and you're aware of something of God's gift, even if it's something that you're just anticipating in the future, there are these moments of joy. And there are moments that can be experienced, I think, in maybe less explicit ways by people who have no faith at all. I mean, this is C.S. Lewis's experience of joy, which is the sense of longing for something, but he didn't know what yet, right? So that's where I'm going to end, and we'll turn it over to Sarah to read her poem, and then we can have a conversation.
The three poems that I've selected for this seminar weekend all come from this anthology of poems that's edited by poet Christian Wyman. If you enjoy poetry or would like to enjoy poetry, this is a great place to start or to continue your journey with poems. And they're all modern poetry, so 20th century and up to the present, including one poem by Emily Dickinson and one by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who are sort of forerunners to modern poetry. But why poems? Why include that in this weekend? As Ben said, I think This gives us both a bit of a reflective space after a lecture to begin responding to these ideas. And also, I like the way that Christian Wyman says it in his really excellent essay at the start of this collection. He says, when I took on this project to create this anthology, I realized that I was somewhat confused about the word joy myself. And I have found that for me, the best way of thinking through any existential problem is with poetry, which does not think through such problems so much as undergo it. Subjected to poetry's extremities of form and feeling, what might that one word in these wild times mean? And of course, this weekend, we do want to think through this question or problem of happiness and joy and the good life. But might we also, with the help of these poems, somehow undergo the problem? I think that this is what art of all genres has the capacity to help us do, maybe even the calling to help us do. And later in Wyman's essay, he notes that many of the poets included in this anthology are, through their poems, not defining happiness so much as testing that abstraction against reality. And this fact, which Ben has already spoken about, that reality pushes back on any of the conscious or subconscious or unconscious abstractions that we live by is something that we talk quite a lot about here. So perhaps a few questions that we could keep at the forefront of our minds tonight and throughout this weekend. How is reality pushing back on me, on my conceptions of happiness, joy, and the good life? Is reality trampling my ideas? To what extent is reality a consideration for me at all as I navigate my own attempts to live a happy life? Have I given up on happiness as a possibility? Does that jive with the greatest realities that I believe to be true? One of the reasons that poems are helpful companions in life, and I hope helpful even in the conversation that we'll have tonight, is that they provide us with memorable speech, words that we can remember and hold on to and turn over in our minds and discover new depths of meaning. One 20th century literary critic said that poetry increases the stock of available reality. And I think this is what we need. We need things. And I think poems are things that make our own lives available to us. And I hope that this poem and the poems that we'll read tomorrow make happiness and joy, our own happiness and joy, more available to us. So I'm not going to say a lot about the poem, but I'll read it for us. And afterward, I would like you to share three things. Words that you like for whatever reason or for no reason at all. Words you like. Images that are crisp, that sparkle for you. And an idea or a feeling that moves you, however it moves you, to delight, to tears, to joy, to relief, to question, to wonder. So words that you like, images that are crisp, and an idea or a feeling that moves you. And we'll share those things as a way of understanding this poem, and we'll continue in our discussion after that. So this poem is called Joy by Liesl Mueller. Don't cry, it's only music, someone's voice is saying. Know when you love is dying. It's only music, and it was only spring, The world's unreasoning body run amok like a saint's with glory that overwhelmed a young girl into unreasoning sadness. Crazy, she told herself. I should be dancing with happiness. But it happened again. It happens when we make bottomless love. There follows a bottomless sadness, which is not despair, but its nameless opposite. It has nothing to do with the passing of time. It's not about loss. It's about two seemingly parallel lines suddenly coming together inside us, in some place that is still wilderness. Joy, joy, the sopranos sing, reaching for the shimmering notes while our eyes fill with tears. What are some words that you like? And you can just shout them out. For me, amok.
Bottomless. Shimmering. Mm-hmm. I love the way she pairs a big word with a small word, like she says, only music. Only spring.
Mm-hmm. As if there's any only about those things, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Other words you like, or perhaps images that are crisp here?
The wilderness inside us.
Still wilderness. I love that because still means two things there, right? Like a motion that has found a stillness, but then also something that remains wilderness. Yeah.
Seemingly parallel lines. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Shimmering notes.
Mm-hmm.
Nameless opposite.
Mm-hmm. Not despair, but its nameless opposite. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to wonder, is it joy? She names the poem Joy. Like, is that what she's taught? Is that the nameless opposite of despair? Joy? But we can maybe name it. And ideas or feelings in this poem that move you in whatever way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm confused if we're supposed to be happy or sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's the gift in this poem. Because, and I think that maybe this is part of what characterizes the confusing seascape, you know, is we think we're supposed to feel one thing at a time, or maybe one thing in a moment, and I think I don't know. I mean, do we ever feel just one thing? Or what if we don't feel the expected thing?
But sometimes when you're happiest, mm-hmm. your eyes fill with tears.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that unreasoning sadness is about longing.
Yeah.
And I think what you said, Ben, about this awakens in us a memory for what was, what has been lost, what we ache for still.
Mm-hmm. That the world is run amok with glory.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite an image.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it's just our perception that it's mm-hmm. amok, mm-hmm. but it's because there's so much more that we can't see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'll just end with one comment, and then Ben, you can carry on with our discussion tonight. In his introductory essay, Christian Wiman comments on those words, still wilderness, some place that is still wilderness, this place inside of us, these two parallel lines coming together. He says this is the place that is most us yet remains beyond us. And he thinks of something that Augustine says of God, you are in me deeper than I am in me. And Wyman says, the particles of burned out stars that are or are trying to be still on fire, all this intimate and alien energy, all this rejuvenating and ravening matter stilled. But this thing, you know, we are made in the image of God, and God is in us deeper than we are in us.
Is there a mystery?
Mm-hmm.
Who finds, come together in the world?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, feel free to keep chewing on this poem, but also, what else do you want to talk about tonight? Yeah.
This is, I know it's very late, and I apologize for how late it has gotten, but if anybody would like to carry on the conversation, that's what we do every Friday night. If you need to leave now, that's just fine. So no guilt there or anything like that, but... I'll carry on for a while, and then I'll probably just pull the plug at some point.
Take a minute to stand up.
Yeah, you want to stretch? Sit, take a deep breath, stretch. Is that yours?
Yep.
Oh, that was a nice one. I was going to take it. Steel pens.
They were all stacked up in a building because I was giving them away.
Hi, Tom. I think a different topic. I've got weird questions. So, I don't know if we'll get to it tonight. It might be too late already. I don't know what time it is, but what time is it?
It's about 10.
10, oh, that's not too bad. That's not bad. If we get time to it, I've got a couple
questions. Oh, okay.
I don't know if you can answer them or not. Maybe there's someone else here who's a bird expert.
What is it you want to know?
Oh, well, I want to know... about their hearing.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and I'd love to know how they feed when, well, I kind of know how they feed. And where do they go at night?
Okay.
See, we feed the birds in our house.
Yeah.
And and a lot of them.
Yeah.
We feed a lot of them.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about some of those questions.
Yeah, I'll think about this. I'm going to start the.
Sure.
Okay, if you would like to keep on talking and maybe go out and have another brownie, please feel free to do that. But if you want to take part in the discussion, please have a seat. Any thoughts? Yeah, Megan.
Well, I was thinking by the idea of primary currency. And I'm kind of bored, honestly, although I guess it shouldn't be, that someone who has given so much thought to this and has kind of unearthed the concept of meaning doesn't have anything solid to give to me.
Yeah.
But my question is, a lot of what you said about our culture's sense of autonomy as happiness rings true, and yet I feel like at least for younger generations,
know that not everything about business is money. There's a sense of we want to work in a place like with a good culture or providing something of meaning to people. And so maybe I'm mistaken in thinking that that, for some people anyways, derives the importance of money. And so I don't know.
You're talking about his analogy between a business, the value of a business, like, and then the...
I know that... to some people it's the bottom line, the bottom line, the bottom line. Maybe people make a good work culture because that is part of what drives their bottom line. I don't know.
Can I say one thing before? And do you have another question? Or?
No, I guess that's the gist of it.
I think, I mean, if I understand his analogy there, I don't really know how much I want to defend anything that he said necessarily. So, but my understanding of what he meant was, if you're talking about the value of a company, as in what it would sell for, if you were selling it, you have to quantify everything in monetary terms. When you talk about the value of a company, if it's not in monetary terms, then it doesn't really compute. And he's saying that happiness is like that for human life. I don't think he's saying that that's what gives a human life value, as in like a happy person is more valuable than. But I think he means, that you have to take all these other things you might be doing and decisions you might be making and in a sense translate them into happiness to discern how much worth they have for your life. In the way that an economist wants to quantify everything in monetary terms so they can add and subtract it and sell it or whatever. He's saying we need to do a similar thing with happiness in our life. Anyway.
Completely. I mean, to some degree it rings true, but another way, I feel like there are a lot of people who at least think they're altruistic in the world. I don't know. It just doesn't completely make sense of the bottom line.
Heather.
I just wonder, do you think that the narrative that we tell ourselves that we can be completely free is actually a ruse, and that in truth our culture does have more of a set of commonly shared values than we are willing to admit? I don't think they're all Christian. I think there are ones that are, but I mean, I just feel like there's a constant contradiction. Why didn't they get so upset about the Me Too movement? Anyone can have whatever they want. Or, I mean, there are any number of things where people cry out for justice. How can you cry out for justice if you don't actually believe that there's some standards? And even, like, in the subtext of these books you're referencing, these people don't want to say that there's, like, some kind of morality. But it's almost as if it's implied.
They have to assume it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I think there's a lot of there's a lot of moral principles that people hold because of their, I think, sort of image of God intuitions, I guess. Maybe, I don't know, that's that they don't have any philosophy or theology to explain or to back up or to provide a foundation for it. I mean, I think it's true. I mean, that's even someone that doesn't believe there's any such thing as universal morality will get upset when you crash into their car I mean, Tim Keller has said this, something that I found helpful. Like we always, it's in response to the accusation that Christians are hypocrites and they behave much more poorly than their morals would require them to. So we're hypocrites. And then his response is, well, why do you behave so much more morally than your worldview requires of you? Why are you so good? Nothing you believe gives you any foundation for why it's better to do this and that, and but yet you do. It's amazing. I think that's true. Part of it is I think just that we're made in the image of God, and there's some kind of, in varying degrees maybe, but some kind of like moral sense or conscience. But I think there is also what I was describing earlier, sort of residual morality, residual ideas of what a human being is, that they have value and that all people are equal, and all these things that only come from the Bible, but have been undermined as the authority of the Bible has been undermined. Those things are still held and affirmed sort of frantically by people as the bottom has been hollowed out from under it, right? And that's where I think you see sort of how long does the residual sense of what right and wrong is last when there's absolutely no foundation underneath it? I don't know. I mean, I think that there is rightly a lot of moral outrage about the Me Too movement is moral outrage, rightly so. But at the same time, it's like, well, we should be morally outraged, but also not overly surprised that these things have happened in a culture that idolizes sexual freedom and idolizes autonomy. And said, you know, like, really? Do we really? Anyway. I don't know. Any other thoughts on that question? It's a good question. Yeah.
It seems to me, I'm not sure it's the same question. it strikes me very naive. The guy's very naive to think that we can be sovereign over determining what's going to make me happy.
Yeah.
So many people are just beating up on themselves for guilt, for duties, and all sorts of stuff that they've inherited, and they can't just get rid of it.
Yeah.
They can't just throw it away. So that was when I grew up. That was when I listened to my parents or grandparents. Mm-hmm. Those things are stuck there, and it may take a huge amount of it. Mm-hmm. Not that we're totally stuck, but so many people struggle with wishing they could reprogram their approval system.
Yeah.
Even Freud, his classic line is, the psychoanalysis is just to bring people up to ordinary human unhappiness.
Yeah. As opposed to pathological unhappiness. Yeah. What did you say, Andrew?
Yeah, well, he had more realistic goals than America.
Ordinary human unhappiness. Wow. Yeah. Thomas. Yeah.
Young, a comedian called Fred Allen, some of you might have remembered him, and he was probably the foremost comedian and the most famous comedian successful on the stage. And he said this, that we work and strive, work hard all our lives for happiness. He did not use the word happiness. What he said, we work and strive all our lives to become famous. And then when we've arrived there, we wear dark glasses so nobody will recognize us.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah. Happiness is fleeting in that sense.
Right. That's an example of the hamburger that... the rat race, the hamburger I was just trying to connect it to the hamburger thing, but never mind, I won't bother.
I have to say, the hedonism hamburger looked awfully similar to the happiness hamburger.
It's just a different color. Yeah. Different color. It's hard to do those fine distinctions on a dry erase board. Yeah.
I was just at my 50th college reunion last weekend, and the motto of the college is, I never studied Latin, sorry, someone can help me, not to be ministered unto, but to minister. Very Christian idea. And what was interesting was, at the same time, this is a really high-achieving college. I mean, it's where Hillary Clinton went. Mm-hmm. And my classmates are...
overwhelmingly incredibly high achieving and have been very successful, et cetera, et cetera. But they still, a lot of them kept, and the president, keep referring to this non-ministrare sentiment, you know, not to be minister, but to be, so they frame it still very much. All the success, all the wealth, everything that's accumulated. My class gave $26 million to the school.
Most of that was from you, right?
but it's interesting because I think that just, I'm not sure if that happens, but just the fact that there's still, at least in a lot of places, and my class, of course, for, I don't know about younger classes, this is class of 1968, there's still that sense that what we're doing is we're ministering to the world. We're making the world a better place. It's not all about my achievement for myself. And yet it's, I don't know, I just felt...
Did you get a sense that was disingenuous in terms of...
I think there's a real sense of sincerity about that, but which then makes it difficult to know how to undermine it, but how to question it, you know.
In terms of people's satisfaction with their lives.
A huge amount of self-satisfaction with that.
Somebody have a hand up over here?
Becky. I was going to say, perhaps it's unfair to them, but it makes me reflect, and there seems to be a connection in some sense to this sort of self-perpetuating narcissism that likes the sense of altruism. Mm-hmm. Because isn't the true narcissist the one who thinks that they're completely altruistic? Like, they're so engrossed in themselves that they can't see past themselves to the point where they can't see that they're engrossed in themselves. Mm-hmm. That may be unfair to your class. I'm not saying that they're all...
It would be a big generalization to make of everybody.
Narcissists, any means. But yeah. I think to a certain extent, it's really hard to recognize when you're that deeply entrenched in your own autonomous pursuit of happiness. That what makes you happy are the social points for being a good person and the social points you get for altruism. But again, it kind of circles back on the how does this reflect on me instead of just remaining in the other person.
I mean, granted, there are a lot of people in my class who are in helping professions, and I mean, that's what tends to go in different years. You know, there's waves of, you know, there weren't as many investment bankers in my classes. Maybe there have been in later classes.
But on a more generous note, too, I think it also just points to the depth of the human heart that reaches back to wanting more meaning and wanting something beyond just sort of the hedonistic rat race that combines and vacillates between the two extremes.
Joshua.
I just kind of give it a little more positive spin to take over. I think it's also another aspect of what you called, I quite liked, our dormant awareness of a good world. You know, like Jesus says it's better to give than it is to receive. And so there's something about that that's true about how the universe is. Your thing with Tim Keller, well, where does this, like, the sense of doing good and this type of good, where does that... Where does that come from besides you just have this feeling? And maybe the feeling is a clue that there is an order to the universe.
Yeah.
There's a way that things kind of work. And so I don't know. I was just wondering if I want to spin it a little more positive.
Yeah, I think I would lean in that direction too. Not, I mean, obviously, these are real people, and this is a whole class of people, so to make generalizations is the wise. But,
this is all making me think of. Two things. One thing is that happiness is a funny thing in that it can be gained almost only when you are not looking for happiness. So happiness comes when you are looking for something higher than happiness. And happiness is sometimes just like the just a frosting on the cake. And the cake is the real thing you know, you're looking for. And I've been also reading through the Chronicles of Narnia, and in that space where, like, all I think about is that, and everything fits into that. So I'm thinking about how, like, Lucy goes through the wardrobe, and she's the prize. And she doesn't even, she's not expecting to see anything. She's expecting to knock on the back.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes into this world, and she's filled with wonder, and she's filled with, like, the majesty of it all. And I'm thinking of also when Edmund goes through, and he meets the White Witch almost immediately, and she says, well, what do you want? And he says, I want lots of Turkish delight.
Mm-hmm.
And she gives him several pounds, which is like a lot of Turkish delight.
Several pounds is make anybody sick.
It's like a lot of, several pounds is like a lot of anything.
Burgers, Stevens, a lot of burgers.
Yeah.
And Lewis says he didn't look handsome or clever, and his face was all sticky.
Mm.
And and that kind of makes me think of like the hedonism. Of like just wanting, and we all want, you know, some people want their Turkish delight, but in the end it makes them sick.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think sometimes when we stumble through a wardrobe without expecting something, it's then that we get kind of unwintered.
I like what you were saying about happiness is something you often come while aiming for something else, and there's a giftedness. I think I find this with joy, where the way in which we use the word joy very often is these moments of like awareness of God's reality, awareness that sort of breaking through into my mundane world, whatever. Whether it's a moment of intense thankfulness for my children in some moment of the day, or whatever it is, if you go trying to manufacture those moments or seek them out or make them happen, it doesn't happen. It's analogous in some ways to humility. You're like, for striving to be humble and to grow in humility all the time and thinking about humility, there's a self-forgetfulness which is intrinsic to humility, which you're just not going to get it if you're shooting for it, right? You need to strive for obedience and fail, and you'll grow in humility along the way, right? So, but to like set your sights on it, in a sense, I think that's what a lot of this stuff is doing. It's getting away from this idea of happiness and joy as being a gift, and it's something that we manufacture by managing ourselves in a very mechanical way. I will judge this, I will judge that, I will weigh the happiness that this will yield, and I'll make this choice, and it's all your emotional life and your psyche is just this machine you're manipulating.
Yeah,
and it's totally untrue to that. Yeah. Yeah.
Does happiness happen now? Oh no, did it happen now? And it's almost the desperation that makes it so.
Yeah, if you're thinking, are my happiness levels higher than they were yesterday? Like, Lenny. Yeah.
You kill it by looking at it.
Yeah.
The principle is that we find our lives by losing them.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seems, how can such smart people not see it as a byproduct of something else?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going to, you have to look at yourself to measure whether you're happy or not.
Mm-hmm.
Is
there a different word? I was striving for a word other than byproduct, because byproduct makes it sort of devalues it in a way, but it is, it's something that you get while going, but I don't know. I need some help. Fruit of what?
Glow.
The glow.
It's the emanation from something.
It's your bedtime. Max, let's go.
Yeah, I think, to your point about this like residual understanding of being image bearers, I'm sort of wrestling with that. I think even if we don't take individualism and materialism to its farthest possible extent, but just to speak to where the culture is right now, I think there's really only things that we would not like done to us, and things that it may not be beneficial to do because you might get put in prison and then you can't continue to seek happiness. I think we're all like, we're all very willing, and there's a lot of people out there who are very willing to break the law and even to, you know, run that risk to, you know, just continue to seek happiness. Like, we're all sometimes willing to speed to get to where we want to be faster. I think, you know, so, you know, in a sense, the spiritualists are different because they have this higher, you know, moral calling that is like, it plays like a metaphysical sort of weight to the things that they do. But I think perhaps like the materialist skeptic would say,
while the spiritualists have sort of just taken this innate human understanding that our lives are finite and a lot of the things that we don't have some sort of lasting meaning. Hmm. And so we've just tried to create for ourselves some sort of cosmic meaning.
Yeah.
Some sort of ultimate meaning for our lives.
This is something that one of the guys contributing, I think he's a neuroscientist in this documentary you watched on Wednesday. There's the two guys on the screen sitting.
Oh, yeah.
The guy on the right who is just he was this sort of ghostly looking character. Anyway, but he you could tell the way he talked was very reductionistic. Oh, yeah. He was like, you know, when people cooperate together, it produces dopamine in your brain. The same thing that happens when you do cocaine. You know, it's all it is. It's just. You know, there's nothing, it's taking something which is actually a good and positive way for humans to behave, which, you know, any parent telling a child, you know, this is how you should act, this is how you, there's this moral weight to it, and there's, but to sort of clip it and say, well, it's just basically a neurological event in your brain, and that's why people do it, is because it, the reason people cooperate with each other and try to get along with each other is because it produces dopamine. It's like, wow! No wonder the guy looks so miserable in this video.
I think that's interesting, because that sort of runs along the lines that I'm thinking right now, that some of these books make it sound like happiness is the end result of a clever life hack. You increase the dopamine and you're off on your merry way. And there are a whole bunch of books that talk about happiness. Mm-hmm. I don't know when the last time anybody talked to me about happiness or asked me if I was happy. I'm plenty happy, don't worry. but we're actually really bashful about talking about happiness. So on the one hand, we talk about it in this very trivial way, like it's an easily, if you do these things, it's sort of the end result. But maybe it's just because I'm German and stoic and nobody wants to talk to me about happiness. But I don't think we tend to say, are you happy? Yeah. That seems scary, kind of. It's too intimate and all of that. So I guess part of that is that people talk a lot about happiness?
Well, any thoughts?
Like people that talk about money. And maybe there's a correlation.
Mm-hmm. Or do we not ask if people are happy because we want to wade in to that sort of conversation?
There are some people that get really stressed out just by the question, how are you? And I have felt that in my life. Yeah. And there were other students, like another student at Liberty at the same time, we had this long conversation, like, that stresses you out too? And I know one other person too, because I was thinking about it actually after, like, and it's okay that you guys asked me how am I, but I'm like, what do you really want to know? Like, what am I supposed to tell you? Like, And I'm probably overthinking and revealing weirdness in me. But
I want to hear the word okay. That's all I want to hear.
Like, I was thinking about it last night. And when we ask that question, are we really saying, are you happy? Or how happy are you? Mm-hmm. Like, just as a very casual exchange, like, I do think that there can be a much, and I think it often is, but more sincerely, like, how are you? But is the bottom line, are you happy right now?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may be one reason why sometimes I am uncomfortable with it. Like, I'm not sure I really want to tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to be honest. I don't, and I want to be known.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure I do either. You know, like, so anyway.
Yeah. Man, it's interesting.
And I think it used to mean, how do you go in health? Like, how are you in health? This other Liberty student and I actually, like, did research on it on our Thursday at a coffee shop. Like, where did this phrase come from? And it was Cody. He found comfort in that. He's like, I'm just going to start asking people, how are you in health?
Little strong.
Responsive. Well, that's just a more specific question. Yeah, maybe it is, for many people, too intimate a question. Are you happy? I mean, because it has to do with the whole, you know, are you happy in what sense? Are you happy in life? Are you happy in your work? Are you happy in your marriage? Are you happy? I mean, it could get very personal very quickly. I don't know. Judy?
I think that people talk about happy all the time, but they don't use that particular word.
They'll say, how are you dealing with that, or how is that affecting you, all kinds of euphemistic ways of saying, are you happy? But I think that people do tap into, are you happy? They just, that the happy word just isn't used, I don't think.
Interesting, yeah.
It's been my experience.
Yeah.
But it's in our house. We talk about it all the time. I'm not happy, I say.
Greg.
That's true.
I tend to feel like the one word answer or something like if somebody says, how are you? And you say, I'm really well. I tend to feel like that's a sufficient answer for some reason. Because if you say it with sincerity, then you are really well. But like some people say, like, how, like, kind of like, how's your marriage? That kind of thing. It's like, we're really good. Like, we're really good together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But that's like sufficient, you know? Because we are, you know? It's like, we're cool.
Well, if
do I need to say anything? I mean, you know,
if the honest answer is, I'm really well, that makes it okay. But it's a complicated answer.
Yeah, and I think drama is more complicated.
Yeah.
Drama lends itself to negativity and people like that. They hear about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, Marty in the back end.
I just tend to see questions like that as in our culture tending to be sort of cliches. You know, you don't actually want to have a long conversation with somebody about how they are. So, how are you? And you expect a pretty quick answer. Fine, how are you? Or okay, fine. And then you leave it. A lot of cultures, it's not like that at all. You don't even, you know, you call it, in many African cultures, someone calls up and they want to know how, first of all, before they talk about their business or why they called, it's a long conversation. And how's your grandmother? Mm-hmm. And how's your son? And I hear that your daughter was ill. And just more time taken in relating to people as human beings. And it can be the sort of, to me, when I hear, how are you? My cynical side sees it sort of like the have a nice day, which is unbelievable cliche in this
call. I think what it means is just hi.
Yeah.
So I don't interpret it as being like, oh, you're so superficial. It's just that it's just the way it's acknowledging someone's presence. And so in a way, and I think in most contexts that's understood.
Yeah.
So you say, hey, how you doing? It means hi.
What do you mean?
And someone says, yeah, pretty good. It means hi back.
Yeah.
And as long as that's sort of agreed upon, I don't feel like people are being superficial. And I just.
Or they respond by saying, so it's like one guy's like, how are you? And the other guy's like, how are you?
Suddenly in Boston.
I find it a very regional thing because I'm originally from California, and moving here, I noticed it was being said as a greeting, and then also visiting England, what do they say, like, are you all right? And that's also a greeting. It's not really asking if you're all right. But I feel like in, at least my experience, at least friends, not necessarily people I'm just passing, but a friend, if they ask, how are you, it is met. It's not just said as a greeting. But here, I did notice that.
And it depends on the social context, too.
Yeah.
If you're walking past someone in the hallway and you say, hey, how you doing? It's usually understood that you're not going to stop. You're like, have coffee together.
That's a fantastic question.
Allison first.
Well, I mean, I think you've already covered it, but when I moved back to the U.S. and I was in a school building, I'd pass someone and be like, how are you? And I was like, I think the answer is fine, thank you, how are you? But
today was better than yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. My students are driving me crazy. But yeah, it's not a question, it's a greeting.
Yeah.
And I think I started, because I realized I was asking people, and then I felt conflicted, because I'm not asking. So I would say, like, good morning.
Yeah.
Or, like, good afternoon. Or, like, hey, so-and-so. Instead of, how are you? Yeah. How are you? Okay, mm-hmm. let's pretend, you know. Yeah. But I think once I realized it was a salutation, not an inquiry. You know, it's not an interrogative, really. It looks like an interrogative. It's really more of a statement.
Anyway, Sarah, did you have something better to go? Or?
I was just thinking, like, I guess going back to Andrew's comment of, like, you know, nobody's really asking him.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't for help.
Wow. You've come to this. Okay, are you happy?
Hug!
Sorry, go ahead, Sarah.
The context I think I hear it most in, or I've heard it in, you know, with my own parents. I just want you to be happy.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like, exactly.
Wishes, parents' wishes for their children. Yep. Or, and so,
all that matters is what makes you happy. I mean, I've heard this.
I don't know. Just, mm-hmm. Which I think is also, like, every parent, I think, does want their children to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, to, I don't know, just be reminded that we can't always be only happy. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's the weight is put on that, like, this needs to be the predominant or prevailing feeling that you have
mm-hmm.
about
mm-hmm.
life. Or, I don't know. So I don't know. I guess I kind of wonder if how many of us have sort of this looming thing in the back of our head, like, I'm supposed to be happy. Like, that's what Mom wished for me. Or whoever. I don't know. Grandma. you know, and so then is there space to admit when we're not? Or that mm-hmm. we don't even know what yeah. would make us happy?
I think for a lot of, I mean, I think it may be a more of a burden in Christian circles, but like, if I feel unhappy and articulate that just makes me ungrateful.
Yeah.
You know, like, because mm-hmm. particularly if things are mm-hmm. pretty in place in my life and I have a family and I have a job which is reasonably good and part of a church, like, things have come together and yet I'm unhappy. You feel like I'm somehow transgressing because I'm mm-hmm. because I all the circumstances are such that I should be happy.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's.
Do men have an equivalent to the Debbie Downer thing?
Can you explain what you mean by Debbie Downer?
Billy Bummer.
Does kill.
Pleasant. Well, sorry to be a Debbie Downer.
Okay. Yeah. So, rain on your parade.
It's late 90s Saturday Night Live. So yeah. It's a particular time.
I feel like this lecture was the Debbie Downer of the theme. and then you guys are going to.
One of the things I really appreciated was you raising the question, and maybe you could talk a little more about it. Tal Ben Shahar mm-hmm. is what. I mean, it just seemed very elitist for people mm-hmm. whose lives are I don't even think about it, but mm-hmm. I mean, just your question at the end, does this apply to people who are unjustly mm-hmm. imprisoned? But, I mean, mm-hmm. what kind of happiness mm-hmm. is available for people yeah. who are really going
I think he would say, I think he would, yeah.
don't have any hope of recovery yeah. or mm-hmm. child is just run over by a truck or, I don't know. Like whether he
deals,
he must deal with.
He does, he's not, and there's a danger in sort of presenting some of the lectures, there's a danger of simplifying. But I think all the things I criticized were true, I think. But I do think that I don't think he's necessarily saying that through this technique, everybody, if they just tried hard enough, could be happy. Mm-hmm. I think he's. I mean, one of his in his discussion of the fact that meaning and pleasure are both important parts of happiness. He talks about Elie Wiesel's work about people in concentration camps, mm-hmm. and the people that really survived were these people with some sense of meaning, mm-hmm. what they were suffering, some sense of a future, working, you know, surviving for something. And he said that. That sort of made all the difference in that kind of brutal context. And then he was honest enough to say, who in their right mind would say these people were happy?
Right.
You know, and in terms of what they were suffering in the moment, and what they were witnessing, and so he's not totally callous. Although I think there is an undercurrent of elitism there. I mean, that somehow we are. I don't know if it's elitism or just naivete about the real world, like the naivete about human nature, that we can just achieve these things and not get in our own way like we so often do. I don't know.
Yeah.
I need to read more of his stuff to be.
to point specifically about, for example, people in prison, mm-hmm. and this may go in the direction of joy versus mm-hmm. just happiness. But some years back, about 5 years ago, I was corresponding with a fellow in prison, mm-hmm. a Christian fellow, for his first season. And one day I got a letter from him. I was reading it as I drove down the road. And he was sharing me lyrics of a praise song mm-hmm. that he wrote mm-hmm. while in prison. So that was like a wow moment. Number one of two wow moments. The other moment was, as I continued down the road, I sort of said out loud as music, I wonder what this might sound like. So I had the word. All I had was the words, mm-hmm. not the music. Almost instantly, a melody just popped into my mind. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was kind of neat because the following weekend at the house church I was at, someone asked, hey, does anyone know how so-and-so's doing? So I said, well, I can actually share a singing telegram with you. That was amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's something way beyond ordinary. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mary Frances.
Sorry, just something that made me think of that is this isn't really totally answering the question, Marty, but I was just thinking of thinking of music. We sing a lot of gospel songs around here, and there are a lot of those. You know, there were gospel songs written by black people who had been enslaved, who were slaves. Many of the songs were written out of a place of real desperation. And there's a Christian songwriter named Sandra McCracken, and I saw a bit by her where she was talking about a particular song that she wrote in a very dark season of her life. Mm-hmm. And a friend pointed out that many of the songs were written in dark places, but with a forward vision mm-hmm. of what is coming. So yeah. Not so much singing about where we are right now, but where we're going, mm-hmm. the movement towards that. And her song "God's Highway" mm-hmm. Is the song she was talking about, but out of a dark personal place. And just that. And so I think I don't know what that looks like to experience joy sort of in that moment.
It's part of the story.
But I think for the Christian, there is the sense that the moment that you are living right now is neither the end of the story nor right. is the full story.
Yeah.
Right. That's great.
Yeah. Anna.
Yeah, I missed the conversation, so maybe this is a helpful thing you've already said this, but it's related to that because she's talking about forward looking, and I was wondering with this guy,
Tal Ben Shahar.
It seemed like in his equation, there was this present component and this future component, mm-hmm. but nothing about one's past.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that's so often.
Mm.
What we're like wrestling with, what kind of haunts people, and
there's a way you're trying to overcome
your happiness.
Totally.
It was completely absent from the equation.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if more about that.
He may in other places, and this book was the book that I was reading, quoting from mostly, is a few years old. So he's written like 10 books on happiness. So he may have other things. Sure, he has other things to say. But yeah, it's true. I mean, in terms of the, I think that's really insightful. Like in terms of what we have to overcome and get over before happiness is even an option. It's stuff in our past, like, you know, bad memories and broken relationships and things that your dad said to you, and, you know, whatever. Yeah, I agree. It's conspicuously absent. Tom?
I know some of the psychological work on happiness, people have successfully measured experienced happiness and remembered happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And found that for most people, the two are different.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ask me how they make the measurement, but, you know, remembered happiness, for example, might be things like, did I make enough money? Did I go to the school I wanted to go to? Did I hit the checklist?
Mm-hmm.
And then experienced happiness, which is, in the moment, are you experiencing happiness from mm-hmm. what you're doing? And of course, those two things tend to be, you know, to make generalization, those tend to be gratitude, mm-hmm. Relationships and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I have a friend who got Alzheimer's quite early in his life,
mm-hmm.
and he had to make a conscious effort towards experienced happiness. Yeah. His whole life had been lived with remembered happiness, and that was just gone.
Interesting. Okay, yeah.
So I just throw that into the stew as a thing to, because more experienced happiness might happen in jail, for example. There's nothing, you know, looking to the future, looking to the past, but in the moment, someone smiles, you mm-hmm. good conversation, write a song.
Mm-hmm.
And some people would say a life that's strung together with that adds up to more.
Hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think so much a sense of accomplishment or a sense of satisfaction with something you've done in the past or something is can have a huge impact on how we live, and I think there's two very different things going on there. Being totally in the present moment and enjoying something you're doing. There's so many different. This is the kind of thing where there's so many different avenues of conversation in this time. You know, we've been sort of pulling our hair out over the last few weeks. Like, what do you talk about and not talk about? Yeah.
This is sort of a slight spin-off what Anne was saying, but I was thinking too, perhaps some of the reason that we struggle with the talk about happiness is that our culture is so focused on authenticity,
mm-hmm.
and some of the only feelings that are considered authentic now are the ones that deal with our struggles and our pain,
mm-hmm.
and oftentimes now, like, feelings like happiness are considered inauthentic.
Mm.
Because you're not considering the full weight
mm-hmm.
of life's pain.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm wondering if maybe that too is involved in sort of Christian cultural struggle to accept happiness in itself as like the simpler form of joy.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's totally depends on who you're spending time with and who, because I think that attitude is certainly present in different social contexts, even in circles of friends that I've had. To be too enthusiastic about anything, it just means you're a loser, you know. to be just sort of reserved and jaded and kind of cynical and warm. Is way more social cachet, and so to just be totally like unselfconsciously joyful about something is a socially hazardous thing, you know.
Yeah.
Because middle school and high school are times when you pretty much want to shut up about the things you're excited about, just kind of.
Right. I found many people too either aren't expecting and then don't know what to do with if they ask you like how are you and you're like. I'm happy.
Yeah. What's wrong with you?
I don't know what to do with this right now.
I think it so depends on who you're spending time with and what and I think my hunch is that many more people than admit it or are concerned about their happiness, but it's so much of it is the image we try to project, right? And trying to manage the impression we have on other people and try to act as if we don't care very much about anything. I don't know. is a struggle for me in high school for sure.
Yeah, which changes though, I guess.
Yeah.
In high school, that is the deal.
Yeah.
It's cool is to be
yeah.
like that, but then in the workplace,
yeah.
or like for an interview,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you're
yeah,
like, yeah, I don't care.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see how that works for you in an interview.
Yourself, it's joyful and happy and
yeah, yeah.
successful.
Enthusiastic
yeah.
and invested.
So
yeah.
Like you gotta
yeah.
switch gears, and depending on where you're at.
And ideally, you know, find a circle of friends that will help help foster good things in you.
Yeah, like, but even in high school, middle school, there was that initial, like, oh yeah, it's cool to be not joyful.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But then that gets old, really, you know, like, did you really want friends who are always just who cares? You know,
yeah, yeah.
Bad
it is very boring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's part of what I think it's Dostoevsky yeah. that said beauty will save the world.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's part of what he's trying to get at is this feeling of joy that kind of emanates from beauty and from the goodness and truth that beauty brings and is physically tied to and that kind of unspoken language that the poem alluded to that Sarah just
Yeah, do you know where he said that? I've heard that quoted over and over again. Do you know where he said that? Said it in a novel? Or?
I knew Once Upon a Time. I don't remember off the top of my head. Yeah.
But that's very much in reference to the world having lost a sense of goodness and truth. So there was still beauty. In the sense people still respond almost...
Right.
Against their will, even to things
yeah.
that are beautiful.
In the beauty itself, you can see still the glimmers of goodness and truth.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
I think beauty to that depth cannot exist without goodness or truth, because then it just sort of becomes vapid, and like it needs the others to keep it in this sort of golden tension that draws us. But perhaps that is. Is sort of a touching point, or kind of what you were alluding to last week, Dave, as well, about the concept of re-enchantment and how that taps into happiness, and like that sort of emanating beauty is what we're after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to tomorrow. Thank you, everybody. I'm going to call it quits tonight, but thank you.
I wish you'd stay through the fourth directions.
Yeah.
Well, along.
I don't know.
I finish with that.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
But anyway, I was just thinking also this about meaning.
The longing.
Well, my happiness depends in large measure about reaching meaning.
Okay. Yeah.
But
to do that, at the bottom of this is the law.
By yourself doing some things you might want to do, or do something
I want to say.
Meaning,
yeah.
Not that you don't want to do,
yeah.
you try to force yourself to do it.
Like,
yeah.
how
to work
with
it.
And then, like, as parents, like,
you can be professional that way and don't just.
But
have
that reason, like,
then you don't reach the meaning that you
want
that
children.
Only
pursue
happiness.
Right?
Yeah.
That,
I mean,
that will, like, cement you.
If we have a positive
yeah.
meaning,
I mean,
it isn't just something we create for ourselves, then there's,
yeah,
if our meaning
so
comes
yeah.
from God who is
yeah.
other than us, it
yeah.
actually,
yeah.
how will I do that?
And
it means that there's this possibility that we will have to really obey him against some of our desires and against some of our inclinations and not always in every sense, but
okay, wait, let me see this real quick.
But
yeah, it's great.
That's what comes with having meaning from above you, not below you.
As in meaning,
I had a conversation with a person in high school who we were talking about Christian faith, and she said, well, you have church and religion, which is great, that gives you meaning, but I have savings. No. I love sailing. That's what I threw myself into. And that was just an interesting thing. I didn't have the words to articulate it then, but the difference between believing God is above me, who made me and who gives me meaning, tells me that I have significance, tells me that I have a purpose, is really different from someone's hobby that they give meaning to.
Right.
And then expecting that to give them significance back.
But, yeah.
Which is not, it doesn't really work that way.
I've heard it talked about this, and I think the world is full of people trying to get significance in their lives from things that are less significant than themselves.
It's like sailing. She's a human being. She's an image of God. She's more significant than her sailboat.
And
yet she's trying to have her sailboat give her meaning.
It's just not one of the strongest cases for the direction of meaning in life at all,
unless you believe in a God that made you
the words are
for a purpose.
Financial security, and it assumes a lot, but she would say that someone else could find something else to get their life.
Well, I want to say, well, what does sailing do for you when your mom dies? Does sailing answer those questions for you?
You didn't ask her that.
I didn't think to ask her that. I was still thinking about it.
A little bit harsh.
I could have said it nicer. I get a lot of pressure thinking back to my sports. In high school? Yeah, high school and after. You went to St. Mark's, right?
Yes.
You did. What did you play at St. Mark's?
Well, in some ways, I was a very, very good athlete.
Uh-huh.
Because you have... One of the ones who saw the best athletes that are there was great in soccer and in hockey and baseball.
Oh, yeah.
He was captain of both the hockey and the baseball. He would have been captain of the soccer, but, but he himself and other people all saw three captains too much. So. Yeah. He agreed to that. But anyway, and then he was also pretty good at fives.
Oh, yeah.
The game is made only to be played in Groton now, I'm not sure. It's an English game, but they gave up the squash courts, the five courts at St. Mark's, but I didn't like that.
Oh, did they? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They gave them up. Anyway, but he had three and a half sports, and they had squash. The fives is half a sport, because it's not really a world name sport. And the fact he never actually won the tournament.
Okay.
So, but now, he's a much better athlete than I am. I understand
that. Yeah.
But yet I had six and a half sports, and that was pretty good.
Six and a half?
That's a lot.
I don't even know if I can name that many sports, Thomas.
One was soccer.
Yep.
Because I did make the team, the first team, in my junior year, and the teacher was the coach, like seniors a lot, so I was only one or two juniors to make the team.
Right.
And soccer. And then wrestling, I wasn't that good really, but I did make the team in my junior, in my, no, my sophomore year, which is...
Wrestling, that's a miserable sport, Thomas.
Well, I wasn't that good, but I did manage to make the team early, so that was another sport. Another one was tennis, so obviously tennis.
Right.
That was pretty successful. That was probably the best. Well, I said I had three.
Yeah.
And then squash. I won the squash tournament. So that's cool.
Squash. Well, you know this guy.
My father was my.